My name is Andrea. Nice to meet you. I would like to ask, because I know that everything changed, and the only thing that we can do is accept for be fine with that, but then you have a lot of resistance to accept. So what we could do with that resistance?
Oh, well, the resistance is, again, it's where you start recognizing. I mean, it's just natural. You can't wish it away just because you'd like it to not be there. And you have to, you start accepting the reality that, yeah, the mind resists. And it resists change. It resists being peaceful. It resists being good sometimes. But but then it's looking and seeing, wow, that's painful, or that's just really unsatisfying. It really is not a way to really brighten the heart. So it's just that willingness to look, and that's where it takes a real honesty to reflect and because then. You know, the mind is incredibly quick, and we've got, you know, we hire really good lawyers on our side to make a case for all of our defilements. I mean, and it's all very, you know, it seems righteous and good, but, you know, in the end, you realize, oh, this is. It's just this is another form of distraction and creating problems for myself and for others. So it's just that honesty, and it's not a again, this is where patience is so important. This spiritual path is not realized just through wishful thinking or through good intentions tremendous effort. It's realized through patience, just being willing. And one of the things with the English language, you know, it's hard sometimes to convey the, say, religious or spiritual concepts in another language, because they say patience is when you say, you just need to be patient, or you need more patience. Oftentimes in the English language, what that means is patience means sort of putting up with something unpleasant until it's over, which is not a beautiful spiritual quality. You know, but patience from a Buddhist perspective, the word that is used is actually what is called a spiritual perfection, kanti. And some things aren't better translations, or not yet anyway, but the quality of kanti, of patience in English, is a willingness to be present with what one is experiencing, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, whether it's wanted or unwanted, and just just being able to be steady and clear within the experience of what is in front of one, so that's where real transformation takes place. In that kind of clear seeing, so this quality of patience, and I can remember, say, both myself and so many other of my fellow monks, both the Thai monks and the foreign monks, going to Ajahn Chah with a question or a problem or a difficulty or an obstacle in the path, and asking for a solution. And it was really frustrating, because so often just be patient. That was exactly what I didn't want to hear. But, you know, after, say, for myself, just after many years of practice and training, reflection, is realize, oh, this is really, really important. Because change, if there's a quality of like a steadfastness in the awareness and clarity, change is happening and we're not shaken by it.
Thank you.
When that flower is new, if we're aware of its impermanence and we accept that and we know it's coming, is there any reason not to love the flower? Is there any reason not to appreciate its beauty? And is there any reason not to accept it as a blessing just because we know it's going to pass?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what, so that clear on a certain level that allows one to appreciate it more. Because one's not projecting any kind of desire onto it, or, you know, projecting any kind of expectation on it. Yeah, absolutely. The one time there was a group of, I think they're mostly Americans. They were like a few Buddhist teachers, like Jack Kornfield, and there was a couple others in that group. Ram Dass was there, and then a bunch of the senior students, and I can't remember, that was probably, you know, around 1980 or something, and Ajahn Chah was still healthy and teaching, and they came and spent a few days with us, and then had question and answer sessions with Ajahn Chah. And I think it was like on the last day, one of them asked, you know, we're Buddhist teachers and we teach people about right view in Buddhism. It's sort of the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. But what is right view anyway? And Ajahn Chah held up a glass that he had and a cup that he had and said, right view is knowing that this cup is broken. And he said, it's realizing the inherent impermanence and instability of it, which doesn't mean that you're not careful and you don't look after it or you don't use it wisely and skillfully, but you know it is going to change. You know it's going to be impermanent. And so it's that simple truth allows one to, say, take responsibility for it as well, really care for it, or to appreciate it. Again, without, it's when it something is seen deeply and clearly that we don't project our desires and fears onto things as well.
Swamiji, it is more personal question. When you were sharing, I was the other side, the Western monasticism comes to my mind, how the abbots are living their life and everything. The personal question is, you entered the monastic life in a very early age. Okay? Still now, have you ever regret for the chosen life, what you have chosen? And when you are dialogue with your mother, being 100 years, what was her feeling? Have she ever felt that you had made a wrong choice? If not, everything's well with you and with your mother. What makes you to move on? Because being in a habit, it's not that easy every day.
It's why I retired. No, I've never had any. The nature of the mind is the doubt, but it's never really. I've never had a. After my first year or two, I've gone through all sorts of difficulties, but I've never had any sense of doubt that this isn't the right thing to be doing. What I have felt is just tremendous gratitude and a sense of humility that wow, I really lucked out in this lifetime. And met a true path. I met a true teacher. I have lived with good fellow practitioners. And, of course, one of the things Ajahn Chah did, it was in my ninth year as a monk, and he told me to go and be the abbot of the international monastery. And I'd actually, I had spent time there, but I've also avoided it at other times because I just found it really irritating. living with other human beings is not easy. And then, supposing to be in a position of leadership and training, and then it's, there was a learning curve. But I think similar to what Ajahn Chah said, he had these great experiences, but his wisdom didn't really come until the taking on of teaching and training having to be a leader, because you can't lead just by telling people what to do and they're going to obey. Forget it. As you can have all the exalted ideas of what an abbot might be, but in the end, mostly what you do is pick up the trash and close the doors after people. I'm sure that the Swamiji appreciates that. But also the reality of everybody else is a mirror for oneself. And one, if one's willing to learn in teaching or leading others, it's pointing back to ourselves. And it gives us that opportunity to see more clearly our own. It really shines a light on the heart of where our own limitations are, or our own strengths as well, because we do have the opportunity to rise up to the occasion. And I did, and as I said, I have stepped down as the abbot and turned over their duties. And one of the reasons why I stepped down also is it does take a lot of attention, takes a lot of energy, and I was, because I've been an abbot of, because I was abbot of the International Monastery in Thailand for 15 years. I was the abbot of Abhayagiri Monastery, where I'm, for like 21 years before I stepped down. And but what I started seeing in myself that I was, you know, one, I was getting older, and you just don't have the energy, or you don't care, and it's not good. You know, especially in a position of leadership, and you have to pay, you know, have to be willing to pay attention. You have to be willing to do that. And I was just finding myself, you know, seeing things that, you know, before I would point it out or correct or do something, and I was just, well, I'm going back to my kuti, I'm going back to my dwelling place. I think I'll just be quiet and meditate. So that just that inclination, just not that same inclination. It takes a younger person to pay attention to the training of others. So I still teach, and I'm there to, if anybody wants to ask me anything or for advice and whatnot, or the monks want some perspective, I'm there. But and I tend to join in the meditations and the pujas. So it's more of a... And I'm really enjoying it. you know, after many years of just active leadership, to be in a bit more of a I wouldn't say a passive role, and let the new generation of monks take on the training, take on those responsibilities, and try to keep my mouth shut. it's you know, it's too easy to sort of, well, I would have done it like this. it's not useful. And with my family, my family has been incredibly supportive. They had no idea what I was doing, but they'd been very supportive. I remember somebody asking my mother, this is years and years ago, and I'd been a monk for quite a long time already. It was obvious I wasn't going to be doing anything else. And asking my mom, What did you think when he ordained? Did you not have objections? And her response was, oh, he's an adult. He can make his own decisions. And he said, and he seems happy. So it's good enough. So it's quite, and my mother has a strong Christian faith, and she goes. I mean, I met her church group at her 100th birthday. Very sweet people, but she comes to the monastery. She joins the evening pujas. You'll never see her at a morning puja. and joins the teachings. She'll join the you know, tea time queue and question and answer sessions. She's interested in what's happening. She's very supportive. But that, you know, I'm very fortunate. And I'm not unaware of that.
What makes you keep on moving?
Well, I want to be free. You know, it's just and it's very clear to me that it is not just a nice idea. It's a truth. It's a reality. It's a possibility. As a human being, we have this possibility of freedom and ultimate peace. And everything else pales beside it.
Sorry, for one more question. What would be your advice when young monks are wavering in their decision? Wavering?
Yes.
So what would be your advice?
Well, the thing is, one has to be willing to look at that wavering and indecision, doubt that one has, and see it as a doubt. Rather, because oftentimes what happens is we experience wavering or doubt, and then we have a sense of fear or insecurity or projection that I'm not a good enough person because I'm so doubtful or because I'm not clear. I'm not. So then, being able to have that sense of just okay, that's what doubt feels like. That's what wavering feels like. And this is uncomfortable. It's unpleasant. So this is dukkha. This is suffering. It's not sort of suffering in terms of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair suffering. It's that feeling of dis-ease, that feeling of just things not being steady. And sometimes those are harder to work with because we don't want it to be there. But just being able to be comfortable with acknowledging I have a doubt and actually put it, clarifying it. Oh, that is a doubt. That's wavering. That's uncertainty. One of the my own you know, that was for me, in terms of obstacle that I felt in my spiritual path. You know, of course, had everything along with it. But one of the ones that I felt really strongly was like doubt, fear, anxiety. Because you have doubt and you get anxious about it. And you get anxious or you doubt about it. So it goes around and around. And one of the things that really helped me was to it was just reading a short Dhamma teaching and just an analysis of mental states that say doubt and wavering, or that doubt and uncertainty, is a what's called a. You have root defilements in Buddhism. So greed, hatred, delusion, these are your root defilements that stain the mind. And so that doubt and uncertainty being a moha condition. So moha is like delusion. Delusion, and its basic manifestation is lack of awareness. And its counterpoint is just being aware. And just being, returning to mindfulness, returning to awareness, returning to the knowing. And the way to do that, the way to, one of the things that's like oftentimes how we try to counter doubt is by convincing ourselves of something that we won't doubt in, which is not how it works. Because the nature of doubt or wavering is to be doubtful and to be uncertain about it. It's doing its duty. But the way through is just through a continuity and stability of awareness and knowing, and just coming back to the body. Like so often we try to fix our minds and just get more entangled up and bogged down because our minds are a mess. But coming back to the body and establishing mindfulness of the body, using the body as an anchor in continuity of awareness and attention, then you find mental states like uncertainty or doubt or wavering dissipating because it doesn't have anything to grab onto. It's seen. There's a scenes like in the discourses. In Buddhist mythology, you have the figure of Mara, who is like the tempter. He's a tempter. He's sort of like a Christian Lucifer, and so he's a tempter. He's pulling you back into greed, hatred, delusion, into the world of confusion and difficulty. And then the stories of the Mara coming to the Buddha, and there's different stories, but there's the one that really sort of delights me is when coming to the Buddha and saying, you know, you're not really awakened. Come on, you're just deluding yourself. This, you know, you're making this up. This is Mara, the tempter, sort of. And the Buddha's response is, I know you, Mara. And it's just the knowing. And of course, then Mara is seen for what he is and has no recourse but to run away. So it's a mythological image. But it's also how the mind works. The mind building up its worries, its doubts, its fears, its desires, its attachments, and they gain traction. They exist because they are not seen. So that sense of I know you, Mara, just the knowing in the knowing itself is the release and the relinquishment. great.
Pranam. According to you, when you went to Thailand, it was your divine plan or it was your decision? Was it a divine plan?
Okay.
It was your own wish? Number two, is enlightenment is a way or destination?
Is awake or?
Way, path.
Wait, a path. Okay. It
means continuing path or it is a point, destination, certain point. Means we know so, that we have reached there. Is it so?
Okay. None of the above. there's, you know, in the sense of a divine plan, certainly I felt that I was kind of looked after and drawn, but I also had to make skillful decisions and stick to them in order for that to manifest and to continue to stay. Because the mind throws up all sorts of alternative divine plans as well. So we get lost very easily. And then is enlightenment the path? The path is one thing, enlightenment is another. In the sense that, in the same way that, a mountain just exists, it is. And because an awakening or enlightenment or realization is of the unconditioned. Is there a path to see that, to realize it? Yes. But that's not, it's the same way that you, whatever a mountain road, the road from the airport to Rishikesh, Rishikesh exists. But you need a road to get to it. So in the same way that there is truth, and that's it. Truth is one, but paths are many, and there are different, many, many different paths that one can take to realize. But that also, not every path is going to get you there. Not every path is going to take you to the right place. So it's having a wise choice. Of is this path working? Is this path valid? Is it true? That makes sense.
สวัสดีครับพระอาจารย์ I've spent some time in some monasteries in Thailand and different places in the world and different traditions, and at some point I found myself at the San Francisco Zen Center, a practitioner of Zen, and they chant the Heart Sutra. I've been hearing a lot of references to the path here, a path that will take us somewhere. And in the Heart Sutra, daily, in the mornings, we would chant, no knowledge, no path, no knowledge, no attainment, with nothing to attain, one attains. Could you help me understand the paths we're talking about here, and as then, no path?
Right. Well, I mean, that's a flavor of Zen, certainly. And a flavor of the Heart Sutra is from the Prajnaparamita compilation of teachings. So that this it's and there you know you're looking at sort of say ultimate teachings or and you know, and it's really helpful to have those pointers to an ultimate, say, truth or realization. But it's helpful to have some tools. And so that there's a practicality that is say, and I think as say San Francisco Zen Center, yes, you chant that sutra every day, and there's a lot of communal practice, and there's a lot of work that gets done, and a lot of so that there's expedient means, and there is a trying to hold it in the right perspective, and not get. Because the thing is you can't get lost in one or the other in that sense of a holding to ultimate truth. Like one of the epithets of the Buddha, and say in our Pali chanting, vicacharana sampanno, perfect in knowledge and conduct. And so vicca is like true knowledge, true understanding, and that would say equate to the say the truths of the. Of the say the Heart Sutra, and as an expression of the non-clinging, non-grasping of anything, but then perfect in conduct as well. How do you live it? And it's just so essential to live truth in a way. That is, it has this integrity, and 'cause it doesn't make one, just because one is attained to some complete realization, doesn't make one just floating on a cloud of bliss all the time. You actually deal with realities of the human existence, of aging, sickness, death, of contact with the pleasant and the unpleasant. You can't get away from that. Even as a fully awakened Buddha, you still have to deal with the worldly dhammas, praise and blame, gain and loss, and the fortune, good fortune, bad fortune, happiness and ease, discomfort. Those are inevitable realities. Of as long as we're still breathing in and breathing out, we're going to experience that. But to be able to hold it in that perspective of non-grasping and non-clinging is really important. But it's sort of like Ajahn Chah. I think that say right view is knowing that this is a broken glass. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist, and you don't have to deal with it anymore. you still have to deal with it. You still have to use. You still have to look after it. So that the it is important to have that, and of course that's the reason its importance is why it's chanted every day in a Zen monastery, because you and again, I think just the Zen tradition is so practical in terms of, I mean, there's verses for every single little thing that you do in reflection, on contemplation, on the just use of the requisites and ordinary things that you're doing in your life.
So I think I'm understanding that the pith of what you're saying is that you need some support, and if there's a path there, it's not something that exists that I should grasp for. So it's okay to say no path, but it's okay to use a path as a supportive tool for me to...
Exactly, exactly.
Thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
Namaste, everyone. This question is coming from vipassana, vipassana and attachment. So I was just thinking right now, we were talking about looking at a rose and understanding that the rose is going to change sometime. If I do that continuously, do I run the risk of building a narrative in my head or an identity which is always coming in the way of the object and me, which rather than helping me appreciate the beauty of things, actually kind of hinders the beauty, because then when I'm looking at anything, I'm looking at it from a lens of that narrative that is going to change, it's going to change. So I never really appreciate it for what it really is. I do appreciate the thought which comes in, and the thought is beautiful in a way that, yeah, this is going to change. But don't you think that when I do that continuously, and it's possible that I don't have to do it, that's probably my question is also going, is that I'm running the risk of kind of destroying the beauty of it, because there is beauty in objects also. If you look at it without the narrative, without any resistance, a narrative, there is tremendous beauty in things.
Well, the problem isn't the beauty. The problem is how we relate to it. In the same way that the problem isn't that things are impermanent, it's how we relate to it. And so it's whatever we can do to shine a light on our inherent kind of prejudices or biases of the mind. That's what we're trying to understand, because it's not about finding a perfect position that you can be in. What you're doing is finding a place of balance that you're not shaken by anything.
So do you suggest that I do it as a precautionary measure, or after I realize that I'm becoming attached to it?
Whatever works.
Okay.
Whatever works. It's like... one of Ajahn Chah's teachers, a memorable teaching. This practice is, this path in this practice is not difficult. If the defilements come at you low, then you jump over them. If they come at you high, then you duck. You know, because you can't. As soon as you start theorizing, making it theoretical, or idealizing it, you've lost the path.